Hello and welcome to We Are History with me, John O'Farrell.
And me, Angela Barnes.
Today we are doing our first We Are History on lockdown.
We are. We've been in lockdown now, what, for about a month, is it?
About 27 years, it feels like.
That's a bit. How are you coping?
I'm all right. The people I feel sorry for, all those people who did Dry January. Bad choice, guys. Yeah. What were they thinking? The idea that you were never going to go to a pub for the rest of the year did not occur to them.
That's what I miss most, is going to the pub.
Yeah, go to the pub, going to see football matches, seeing friends.
Yeah.
Well, never mind. We can still record our much-loved podcast.
We can indeed. And what better time to learn than when you've got absolutely sod all else to do?
We are recording this sort of 70 miles apart, whatever London and Brighton are.
Yeah.
I am in South London. Angela is in Brighton. But with the wonder of the World Wide Web, we are going to today talk about the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. Well, it's not a load of laughs, is what I'm going to say from
the top. It's not, is it? I think we wanted to do this one because it's such a thing in popular history, isn't it? It's such a thing that people know about but don't know about. I was never taught this at school.
No, this was something I was just always vaguely aware of sort of growing up. I was a big fan of George Orwell's writing as a young man. Yeah. And read all of his works, and of course read Homage to Catalonia. Mm. And I think that was my way into it. But I think I read that a bit too young. And I never really came back to the Spanish Civil War. So when I think you suggested it, Angela, I thought, oh, yeah, actually, I would need to know more about that. And I'm interested in knowing about that. Mm. And for a comedy podcast, you know, what could be better than the mass execution of innocent socialists? So,
calling this a comedy podcast is quite strong, John.
Yeah, you know. I know. We try to be lighthearted. We try to be lighthearted about the stuff that interests us.
Yeah.
Sometimes perhaps the tone might have to be more serious. So I'm going to lead on this one.
Yep.
We're going to record another one after this, which Angela will lead. So don't think I'm an old bloke mansplaining war. That's not what it is.
It is.
So, the war. No, the first thing a lot of people will think of when they hear the phrase Spanish Civil War might well be the famous Picasso painting of Guernica. Yeah. That was a painting commissioned by the Republican government and a famous image of a horrendous bombing raid that happened in the war. And we'll get to what that was and what the context was. But we'll start with a bit of background. Spain, 1930s, very different place to Spain now.
No English bars.
No Benny Hill bar in Magaluf. No Benidorm. An agricultural country, really. A very, very poor agricultural country with a few industrial centres in places like Catalonia and the Basque Country in Madrid. But really, very divided regionally, linguistically and politically. Mm. It had a king, King Alfonsus the VIII. About 25 million people in Spain. Now, Spain, of course, had been a major imperial power in previous centuries, but as is the way with major imperial powers, the ordinary people don't get much of that gold.
There's that famous photograph, isn't there, of the king in his car driving through the countryside in the 1920s, and his car's broken down.
I haven't seen that.
These peasants sort of helping him to, and they just look like different species. They just look like, you know, that there's such a, it's a real sort of photograph of the difference in the imperial, versus the peasantry. Yeah, absolutely. And they're just sort of helping with this car. And in the background of the photograph, there's like a bloke on a horse and cart just looking at them like, what are you doing?
Wow, what the hell's going on there? His wife actually was English born. She was Queen Victoria's granddaughter, born in Balmoral, Scottish born, I should say, British born. In 1931, he called elections. There'd been a lot of turmoil in Spain, a military coup in 1923. Spain had been neutral in the First World War, but a lot of turmoil, a lot of divisions between anarchists and Marxists and monarchists and Republicans. He called an election in 31, expecting to win it. Absolute landslide for anti-monarchists, for Republicans. And he packed up his bag and left. So poor Alfonso.
Not so poor
Alfonso. I think he went to Rome. And his wife went to Switzerland. So that tells you something about the marriage, doesn't it?
Perfect marriage.
Yeah. So then there was a progressive government from 1931 onwards. Spain, having lost an empire, still had this big imperial army. It didn't quite know what to do with itself. Mm. They had land in territories in northern Africa, Morocco, the Spanish-Moroccan territories, and they kept the army there. And this was to play a crucial part in the story we're going to tell. This, the Republican government attempted sort of radical land reform, but was fiercely resisted by the landowners and the church. And the, I have to say, Angela, the politics of Spain, God, it's complicated. Did you try and get your head around?
I started to read, and it is an excellent book, and I will get through it, Anthony Beaver's book.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Battle for Spain.
The Battle for Spain. But the first maybe 20 pages are just a list of the different factions involved.
Yeah.
On both sides. It's like, and it's, you know, it's a people's front of Judea and the Judean people's front. And, you know, there's... To split it into Republicans and nationalists is really oversimplifying a really complicated situation, isn't it? Because you've got capitalists but who are on the side of Republic and, you know, it's not just communists versus fascists. It's not that simple, is it? But that's no, we sort of have worse. To make it that simple a bit.
It's worse than my old Labour Party meetings, I'm telling you. No. So the Falangists were like the small, this very small, not very influential fascist party. Then the anarchists, the anarchism was a big thing in Spain. Mm. And they did actually refuse to take office when they won elections. It's like, no, we're anarchists, we can't. There were socialists, Trotskyists. They would later POUM, the P-O-U-M. They'd be crushed later by Stalin-backed communists. So basically, it wasn't, you know, Tony Blair v. John Major, this politics. It was pretty extreme. It was there was street fighting and the whole first half of the 30s, increasing political violence until 1936, the election of a socialist popular government. And that made the military realise they weren't going to get rid of this government without a coup. Now, this hadn't been the first coup, but this had been the first really well-organised coup. Mm-hmm. And they thought they would have a coup, overthrow the socialists and just be in power immediately. They were not, of course, anticipating a prolonged civil war.
No.
The other thing I'd say is at this point, we've heard of General Franco.
Yeah.
He's
in Morocco at this point, isn't he?
No, he's not actually.
Is he not?
They parked him in the Canary Islands to start with.
Oh, that's right.
They parked him over there just sort of, you know, so he could dodge students trying to sell him timeshares. I don't know if you've ever been to Gran Canaria, but that's basically that's what you spend most of your time doing. Because that was, of course, a Spanish territory. One of the others was he managed to get to Morocco, as you say, to join up with a Moroccan army with the help of a couple of British enterprising secret agents who lent them a plane, and he flew them over, and then. And this coup, you know, rose up in every major city in Spain and was put down and was defeated in pretty well every major city in Spain, except Seville, where they succeeded. But in Barcelona, in Madrid, in Malaga and all these places, the coup was defeated. Now, that would have been it. But
however,
for the fascist forces in the rest of Europe.
This is obviously in the background of the 1930s. So you've had from the 20s, you've had Mussolini in Italy. And from 1933, you've had Hitler in Germany. So there's the rise of the fascists across Europe. So therefore, this sort of the Falangists, the relatively small fascist group in Spain, suddenly gets this support from these quite big powers. Financial support and armoured support and personnel support. And so rather than it just being this small group of fascists against the Republic, they're being financed by fascism as a whole, really.
Exactly. It sort of becomes part of the wider European struggle between the nervous democracies and belligerent fascist states.
Yeah.
So the coup would have failed without, I think that most historians agree about this, would have failed without Mussolini jumping in, airlifting the army from Morocco to southern Spain.
Yeah.
Hitler also lent planes, and they did this within the first week. And they said, we have to hurry up, because Goering said to Mussolini, we have to hurry up because the British will not let us get away with this.
Oh, how wrong they were.
Yeah, because in fact, the British would let Mussolini and Hitler get away with helping the fascists take over in Spain, and they would later let the fascists get away with, you know, occupying Austria, Czech Sudetenland. And this is all part of appeasement policy of the fascists in Europe. It should be seen in that context.
So the appeasement policy's already started in Europe, hasn't it? So therefore... Yeah. Britain doesn't want to provoke war at this point.
No, and also there are plenty of people in the British government, either the Conservative government of the 1930s, who have are on the side of the business interests of the sherry growers and the various British financial interests in Spain, and on the idea of social order in Spain rather than a socialist republic, which might attract the support of the Soviet Union.
Well, that's it, because everyone's paranoid about, after the Bolshevik Revolution, that communism will spread across Europe, aren't they? So that's, at this stage, that's a bigger threat to Britain than fascism, as the government sees it.
Well, I think as the government sees it, I think you're right. So, I mean, it should be said that when this coup happened, almost half the army remained loyal to the elected government. In the first week, one of the leaders of the coup, San Giorgio, how do you say that? San Giorgio.
I've got real problem. I'm really sort of trying not to have to pronounce anything. At my school, we had to choose German or Spanish, and I chose German. And my Spanish pronunciation is really bad.
Just go ha 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 ha. Be like...
there's John's token bit of racism. We get a little bit in every episode.
Racism. I'm doing my best. Doing my best here to make an effort with these saying the J's like an H. That's what you're doing it.
Okay,
Juan Hofheil. But one of the coup leaders was killed in a plane crash, which meant the leadership was split between General Mola and General Franco. Now, Franco was just an army man, but he was quite ambitious. And within the first week, you know, he'd set up his own press office. Mm. And so the British newspapers were referring to this as the Franco Rising.
He had very good PR, didn't he, Franco?
How come your name got attached to this, Franco? It's like, oh, they must have just picked up on some detail. You know, press releases were coming into every European newspaper from his from his own Alistair Campbell, you know. Both sides, started conscripting. Just in terms of the geography of who held where, at the beginning, the nationalists, the fascist uprisers, held the north and the west. That's the border with Portugal. And Portugal itself had its own dodgy quasi-fascist government, the Estado Novo, under Salazar. So they were... all the stuff coming through their ports could come straight to the border and support the uprising. Whereas the Republicans, the legal government, we should emphasise, they held the centre, Catalonia, the Basque countries and the industrial centres. It was a lot of, very much countryside versus cities. Mm-hmm. It's like Brexit, but with machine guns.
Which would have made the whole affair a lot swifter.
Oh, God, what a terrible thought. But as the country sort of descended into civil war, a sort of revolution was happening as well in the more radical parts of Spain. So cities like Catalonia, there was a very feverish atmosphere and a whole new type of society trying to be established. There were some anarchist areas, and this caught my attention, where it was decided they should abolish money. So they actually had meetings, said, right, we're going to burn all the cash. And it must have been, you know, I could take this cash home if you like.
Yeah, I'll burn it when I get home. Yeah.
Shall I do this? You guys go. Yeah. Leave this with me.
I got it. I've got you have this. An early night.
Exactly. Everything was collectivised. So the land was collectivised, but even the barbers. So I
had your state haircut.
Yeah,
my haircut's just a state.
Very good.
Thank you.
I remember seeing Julian Clary, great comic. He used to have this put down line for people in the front row, which was, "Who does your hair? The council?" and I always hated that joke. I mean, I've always got a massive laugh, but I always thought, no, there's no reason why a council haircut couldn't be a great haircut. The socialist in me was going, I'm in favour of council haircuts, but everyone was laughing, so there was no fighting it, I'm afraid. But yes, in this case, the council did cut your hair. Boot polishers, everyone was working for them.
Have you ever been to Cuba?
No, I haven't. Is it like that?
It is very much like that. And you sort of go to the state-run ice cream parlour and things like that. It's...
I'll have a 99, please. Well, if you fill out these forms,
exactly.
we'll get the ice cream back to you in 3 months. What else happened? The fighting bulls that belonged to the rich families were slaughtered, and the poor ate steak for the very first time, which must have been a treat for them all. Very indignant rich families saying, you can't kill our bulls.
We wanted to kill our bulls.
what were you going to do with them?
Yeah, well, exactly. we were going to kill them in pretty outfits.
With lots of people in a long, lingering and cruel death for our own entertainment.
You can't take that away from us.
I know. One other thing about the revolutionary socialists on the Republican side is that they're very hostile to religion. Religion had been part of the sort of oppressive nature of the state in Catholic Spain. There were issues of class around priests and the established church. All the schools, nearly all the schools in Spain were religious ones, and these were closed down. Churches were burned, religious statues pulled down. There's a picture in one of the books I was reading of a firing squad taking aim at the statue of Jesus outside Madrid. Of the Christ. So you can imagine if you're a sort of devout Catholic, it makes you hard to be on the same side as the revolutionaries.
Yeah. And in fact, there were, I think because of that, the other in Catholic, like in Ireland, for example, where they'd had their own uprising, there were, well, I mean, we'll come on to the international brigades and stuff later, but there were volunteer fighters on both sides from Ireland because of the persecution of the Catholic priests in Spain.
Yes, absolutely. It's interesting because my dad was a young man during the Spanish Civil War in Ireland, and his father, they used to get the Catholic Herald in the house, and his father was pro the Franco side because he read the Catholic Herald, and my dad was a fierce young socialist and had big arguments with his dad about Spain. Mm. And in Ireland, they had the ex-IRA men going out and fighting for the Republicans,
yeah,
you know, the veterans of the Civil War in Ireland in 21.
Yeah.
And Ewan O'Duffy's Blue Shirts, who were the sort of pathetic Irish fascist party, hundreds of their volunteers went out and fought for Franco's side.
They do love a dark shirt, don't they, fascists?
Fascists, yeah.
Black shirts, brown shirts, navy blue shirt. It makes me feel like their biggest concern was stains.
Never pink shirts, is it?
Never
we
pink
are.
Shirt.
We shall be known as the pink shirts.
The lilac shirts.
The beige shirts. And all of Europe is falling under the jackboot and the beige shirt. No. I think Franco sort of adopted the fascist sort of uniform, the salute, of course. I don't think he was an ideological fascist in the same way as Mussolini or Hitler. He wasn't. He was really a very conservative politician who wanted the military in charge.
It just suited him to have their money, didn't it? Rather than
it suited them to have their support and their and it was sort of fashionable in the 1930s, right, to have, you know, to be a fascist. So I don't think he was motivated in quite the same anti-Semitism. I'm sure he wasn't anti-Semite, but not quite in the same mad and obsessive way that Hitler was. But the thing about the breakdown of social order that followed this revolution is that everyone was being given guns.
Yep.
To fight the fascists. And if you just got a load of mad people in a revolution all being given rifles, there's going to be a lot of, in a violent society already, there's going to be a lot of scores and a lot of grudges and a lot of old vendettas and the old grievances being sorted out.
Absolutely. And a lot of this was exactly that. Was it street fights? It was local neighbourhood vendettas and, under the guise of it being part of this greater...
That bloke who gave me a bad review on Amazon, he would be, I'd be after him. That Daily Telegraph radio reviewer. That's what it was like, though. It was people people were murdering neighbours on the flimsiest of pretexts. You know, they're saying he was a fascist collaborator, but it was basically he nicked my girlfriend when I was 16. You know, it was all sorts of people who hated other people were killing them and getting away with it. It was Twitter trolls with revolvers is what it was. So terrifying. Meanwhile, so while the Republican side were trying to have a revolution and fighting a war in their different regions, you know, the Nationalists, which gradually became led by Franco, they were just totally focused on the war and whatever was most effective to that end. Franco was a very, very effective military man.
Are you saying, John, that the left were busy fighting amongst themselves while the right just... got together and got on with it. Is that what you're saying, John?
Unprecedented in history.
I know. It'll never happen again, will it?
The right were focused on the winning. The left were arguing about the means and we're anarchists. We don't hold positions of authority. Oh, for God's sake. Yeah, so you know, Franco was not a particularly religious man, although his wife was, but he was a conservative. And
I don't think his wife was a religious man. We should probably...
No, his wife was a religious person. and he was just a conservative who became a fascist, you know, to suit his purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But they, as I say, they adopted the salute. And as for the brutality of fascism, well, they certainly adopted that. It was the it was the most brutal and murderous of wars. And the thing I'll say about the difference between the murder on both sides is that on the Republican side, murders and vendettas and executions happened because social order broke down and people took the law into their own hands and mm-hmm. killed each other for no good reason quite often. But from Franco's side and from the nationalist side, it was the policy of the authorities to murder opponents, to kill anyone who stood in their way, and to execute intellectuals, suspected left-wingers.
Which was a fascist policy across Europe, right?
Yeah, of course,
to kill
of course,
communists, just, Jews, yeah. intellectuals.
Yeah. So the beginning
socialists.
Of the war, someone like the Spanish playwright Federico García Lorca was mm-hmm. just murdered by the nationalists for being an intellectual and for being gay. And he had moved to a different part, a dangerous part of the countryside, thinking if he went home, he'd be safe. They dragged him out of his house, shot him. They said, "I shot him twice more in the arse for being queer." That was the nature of the...
That, I mean, that's medieval. That is literally Edward II was killed, wasn't it? With the red hot poker up his jacksie for
the
same reasons.
So it was a free-for-all in terms of murder, but very much encouraged by Franco and his side. On that grim murder of a great playwright, I have a huge poster of Lorca that I've had ever since my university days. It's too big to put on any wall. I don't quite know what to do with it, but I always had this massive sort of face of Lorca staring down at me in my university days, and I've got it rolled up in the loft now. I'll have to tweet a picture of it for people to see. But so I've always felt a connection with Lorca because he's staring down at me every morning when I have my breakfast. there, we're thinking of the murder of a playwright. We'll take a break, have a cup of tea, and we'll get on to the European powers and what they did and didn't do. Listen to an advert or two from Acast, and we'll pretend we had a cup of tea in the gap.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones. Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back. Hope you enjoyed those adverts. Whatever they were for, we didn't choose them. That's all you need to know. We got our hands burnt when we kept having Telegraph adverts put in.
Although we did tell them to stop those.
We did tell them to stop the Telegraph adverts, and they did. But anyway, we are back to talking about the Spanish Civil War. Where had we got to, John?
We'd got to the brutality of both sides, but the planned and intentional brutality of Franco's side. And just to paint a picture for you, the Republicans, the legal government, hold most of the cities and the central bit of Spain, the southeastern corner, and the Basque Country. Franco's forces hold the very fiercely Catholic and poorest agricultural regions of the north, the border with Portugal, and Seville and Cadiz. But, you know, as I said, the initial coup had in effect failed, which is why they were having a civil war. And then Mussolini became very involved for ideological reasons, really. There's a difference between the involvement of the two fascist powers of Europe. Mussolini believed in the fascist cause and was pouring weapons and troops into Spain for that. Germany was testing out equipment.
Right.
Seriously, they were just like, they lost interest. Once they'd realised what they could do with their bombers, they took them off back
to Austria.
I suppose
Spain wasn't a particularly strategic location for Germany, was it, in terms of...
Well, I suppose for shipping in the, you know, the Mediterranean, it was quite important. You know, Mussolini wanted a fascist Mediterranean. He actually turned Majorca into an effective Italian colony.
Yeah.
And they did their bombing without even consulting Franco. And he would find out about it afterwards. So it was quite humiliating for the Spanish coup leaders that they were not really part of this. But, you know, eventually
there
were 50,000.
The air bombing raids during the Spanish Civil War were sort of... came from Germany, really, not
and Italy, from, and Italy, yeah.
And Italy,
I mean,
yeah.
They had their own air force, but nothing like the German or Italian air forces.
Yeah.
And they didn't have all the planes, of course. Some of the Republicans had the airports. So this question, it was all very complex, and there's no hard and fast rules about any of this. But the great military difference was the assistance that the Germans and Italians gave and the lack of assistance that the Republicans had from anyone until the Russians a bit later on. The Moroccan mercenaries were fighting for the nationalists. We had 50,000 Italian troops coming in. You had 600 planes from Germany coming in, 200 tanks. Italy gave 660 planes, 150 tanks, 250,000 rifles. And then you had the Portugal under the Estado Novo giving logistical help and letting the nationalists use their port. So the only countries in the world which supported legal government were Russia and Mexico, who openly supported the Republicans. But that's, of course, no strategic use at all.
Because the rest of Europe obviously have adopted this non-intervention.
Yeah, well, basically France and Britain were the major powers of Europe. And America followed suit as well, actually, of non-intervention. So we'll talk about the bombing of Guernica. That was a market day in the Basque town of Guernica, not a military, you know, not a place where they made armaments or anything. The planes came in waves, bombing people in the market. No one knows how many civilians were killed. Some say 200, some say 1,000, but they were bombed and then they were followed up with machine gunning. And that became one of the most famous atrocities and war crimes of the Spanish Civil War done by Italian and German planes. I think it was Italian and German. I think mostly Italian, I think. This was, the bombing of Guernica was denied by Franco's government because it was an international outrage.
Well, did they not suggest that it was the Republicans themselves had staged it?
Yes, they said they'd done it for propaganda purposes.
Yeah.
They had blown up their own town to show the world these terrible images. And it remained a crime in Spain for decades and decades afterwards to say that Guernica had been bombed by the nationalists. So well into the 50s and 60s, I think, you couldn't mention Guernica.
Wow.
Mussolini continued to pour money and troops into the civil war. And all this was building a massive debt up for Franco, the nationalist who would eventually win, which, of course, evaporated when Hitler and Italy lost the Second World War. So all those bills, they were like,
disappeared.
Wow, no. They completely disappeared. So it was, from that
disappeared
point of view,
with
it was
the fascists.
Yeah.
But at this point, of course, I suppose what Guernica did was show the rest of Europe the power of the Luftwaffe, right? And the
exactly. That's
gave
what
them
Germany
something
was
to fear.
Germany was testing out these machines because it was a new thing. Aerial war was not something really, bombing was not a significant thing in the First World War. This is the, you know, they're learning to do this, really.
This is why
it's
it amazes me
the rest of Europe.
That when we learn about World War II, or certainly when I did at school, that this wasn't really covered as such a precursor to it, which is what it so clearly is, right?
It clearly is a rehearsal for the Second World War in terms of the sides and the techniques. Remember the First World War was all trenches and then they invented tanks, you know, and so trenches no longer became a thing. And then they invented air war and these were tried out to with great and terrifying effect in the Spanish Civil War. So the only people really giving military help to the nationalist side were the Russians. And the Soviet Union were giving tanks and money.
This is Stalin at this time,
Stalin,
obviously.
Yeah. Now he was, you know, pretending to support a democratically elected socialist government, but he sent more and more advisors and gave more and more instruction and increased the division between the Stalin loyalists on the nationalist side and the Trotskyists. Well, actually, it's unfair to say that POUM, which is P-O-U-M.
They were condemned as Trotskyists, but they weren't really, were they? They were just and not Stalinists.
Exactly. And George Orwell writes about this a lot, doesn't he, in Homage to Catalonia?
Yeah.
You've been reading that, Angela?
I have been reading it. I am at least a third of the way through. I only started reading it yesterday or the day before. So that's, you know, I'm very busy with my crochet during lockdown, John. Okay. So, you know, I can only do one thing at a time.
But it is a crochet about the Spanish Civil War, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's immense. The Bayeux Tapestry's got nothing on what I'm producing right now.
So on one side you've got the Soviet Union supplying tanks and guns, and on the other side you've got the Germans and Italians. Meanwhile, Britain is saying, well, let's have a non-intervention committee. Yes. And so they have this actual committee which sits and meets, you know, like the League of Nations thing, and Germany and Italy on it, and they sit around discussing how non-intervention is going. What's that loud exploding outside? Sort of dive bombers. That's nothing. Literally, the Italians and Germans were stalling and denying the whole time, as they were very much were intervening, even though they sat at these non-intervention committee meetings. So then you have volunteers.
Ah, this is the thing I find fascinating. And I think this is the thing that people know most about the Spanish Civil War, because they know that Hemingway and George Orwell and these sort of creative people went. But I just find the whole thing fascinating. So volunteers came from all across Europe and America and South America to fight for the Republic, various factions, either as part of the International Brigade, or there was Poom, which George Orwell fought with, who were the so-called Trotskyist, but essentially just non-Stalinist. So the International Brigades were funded by Communist International, by the Comintern, pretty much, so Stalin's in Russia. They attracted volunteers who were, I suppose, in Britain particularly, the volunteers that went, and I can't remember the number, I know there were like 500 from Scotland, there were lots from Wales, at mining communities.
I think at least 1,000 from the UK.
At least 1,000, I think possibly more.
I think you're probably right.
And generally speaking, they were trade unionists. They were members of their local communist party, which were often one and the same. They were people from mining villages in Wales. So there's this sort of perception, I think, that a lot of the volunteers were kind of middle-class artistic types, because we know about Hemingway, we know about George Orwell. But actually, the majority of them were working class, you know, manual
laborers. Working class socialists, I mean, I think the thing about Orwell and Hemingway, I'm not sure actually was at the front. I think he was writing.
No, he was there as a journalist.
In Madrid, And Orwell went as a journalist and ended up signing up and got shot in the throat, and his health never really recovered.
He did.
He had to go from, when the war came, because he'd been seen action in Spain, he was put in charge of his home guard. He volunteered for the home guard. So it's like dad's army with George Orwell, and it's hard to imagine.
That's the thing, but the British particularly were seen as being more experienced in warfare. So when the volunteers came to fight for the International Brigades, they were seen as being, or they certainly felt, superior to the Spaniards, because the Spaniards hadn't fought in World War One, and so they had more recent experience of war. However, the truth is that by that time, by the 30s, most of the people who had fought in World War One were too old to go. Yeah, so there were actually very few actual veterans from World War One that went to Spain. But being British, they thought, meant that they had this superiority in warfare, which caused a lot of clashes with the locals. And the locals generally, local Republicans were, you know, pleased to have the support. But there were, you know, the international volunteers had a tendency to go and get pissed up in local bars and cause havoc. And, you know, there were clashes and there were, you know, problems like that.
I mean, some famous people there. You had Jack Jones, who became General Secretary of the Transport and General Workers Union in my childhood. Every time he was on the telly, my dad always went, fought in Spain, fought in Spain. Earned him an enormous amount of respect on the Labour left. It was like, to have fought in Spain was to have made that sacrifice, you know, to have gone out.
Absolutely. You had Laurie Lee.
Laurie Lee.
Some of the interesting people that came from Europe, I found, was Willy Brandt, who went on to be West German Chancellor.
Was he out there as a negotiator, though, more as a soldier? I read about him. Because also, I'll tell you who's also out there.
Mielke.
Ulbricht.
Ulbricht was there. But Erich Mielke, who was the leader of the Stasi.
Yeah. So some of those were there as Stalin's agents, I think, rather than as heroic sort of fighters.
Paul Robeson as a sort of entertainer. Yeah.
Good old Paul Robeson. He was a great character, he was.
He suffered for that later at the hands of
He did. And it's
McCarthyism and all of that.
Listen to our McCarthy podcast and you'll hear about poor Paul Robeson.
You will.
Esmond Romilly was Churchill's nephew, but a firebrand socialist, and he volunteered in Spain and flew out there. Stephen Spender, the poet, I think, was more an observer than a soldier. Virginia Woolf's nephew died out there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, people we've not heard of because they died and they never came back, so yeah. They didn't become famous.
I think the motivation for the volunteers is quite interesting. I read somewhere, and I can't remember which book I read, so I'm sorry I can't attribute this to whoever I read it in, but somebody said that to recruit volunteers, you have to be defending something. So, for example, in the Boer War, volunteers were recruited to go and fight because they were sold the idea that they were defending the empire. Wow. Whereas in order to commit aggressive action, you need conscription because you can't encourage
you can't
people. Yeah, you can't sell it. Whereas a defense, you can. And I think the thing that was being defended, particularly, I guess if you were a socialist, a communist, or even just, you know,
Democrat,
an artist or a Democrat, or if you were homosexual, if you were Jewish, remember we'd had Cable Street had happened. In the East End, you had Mosley and the Black Shirts going on. You were threatened if you were in any of those groups. You could see the rise of fascism and you could see that fascists killed those people.
So
it wasn't seen. It was seen as a defense of their way of life and their way of being and their political beliefs and stuff. So it was understandable, I think, that the volunteers made that journey. The journeys were funded by the Communist Party. So to get to Spain, for example, and this was something quite interesting. So in Sweden, the majority of the volunteers that went to fight from Sweden were sailors. And the same from Australia. The majority of volunteers that came from Australia were sailors. And that was because to get from Australia particularly to Spain would be really expensive. Whereas if you were a sailor, you could make your way by working on ships.
Oh, God, how amazing. Okay.
Of course. Yeah, and so that's why the majority were. Whereas in Britain, what they did, if you wanted to volunteer, what you would do, you'd have to be interviewed first by your local Communist Party, usually. You'd be interviewed to check that your communist credentials and your reasons for wanting to go were, you know, fit with the ideals that they were fighting for. And then you'd be sent to London. And when you got to London, you would be issued with a return ticket to Paris. And this was because at that time in the 30s, you could go to Paris without a passport for a weekend.
Right.
As long as you had a return ticket.
Wow.
So, and that was to facilitate lots of young men going for dirty weekends in Paris at this particular time, which is quite fashionable to do. So they were bought, the Communist Party would buy you a return ticket to Paris. And then from Paris, the Communist Party in France would take over. They would get you to the Pyrenees and get you across
to Perpignan,
the Pyrenees.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, this was illegal. It should be said that you weren't allowed to do this because we were we had a policy of non-intervention, so British people were not allowed to volunteer.
You had the Foreign Enlistment Act, which was from 1870, which says you can't join an army of another country if Britain's neutral.
Right.
That was a response to the Civil War in America.
Right. But I mean, it should be said that however heroic and well intentioned the motives of these volunteers was, they didn't make that much difference militarily. I think there were enormous value in terms of propaganda and morale for the Spanish to see thousands and thousands of people flocking over the Pyrenees to join the Republican cause. 10,000 French people volunteered fight in defence of the democratically elected government of Spain.
The recruitment of them was quite interesting as well, because you couldn't directly recruit for volunteers because that was illegal. So things like the communist socialist newspapers would report on the volunteers but wouldn't actively say this is how you recruit. But there were propaganda posters and things, and that's where, you know, the Manic Street Preachers song, "If you tolerate this, then your children will be next."
Oh, right.
And that was propaganda to British potential Communist Party volunteers. And it was pictures of bombers in the sky
picture,
and dead children, you know. And it's "if you tolerate this, then your children will be next." And that's what that was for. It was propaganda to recruit volunteers.
And there's actually a great memorial to the International Brigade here in Lambeth. It's a statue in Jubilee Gardens in memory of the International Brigade people who went out in the 30s. So illegal in the 30s, but now today in the 21st century, we salute them and we build statues to them quite rightly too.
I think it's worth saying as well that at that time in the 30s, although the International Brigades were funded by the Comintern, were funded by Stalin, obviously Stalin's greatest crimes hadn't really come to light at that point.
Oh, no.
I think to say they were Stalinist in our heads in the 21st century,
yeah,
you know, it didn't mean what that means now.
No, quite. And people like Dennis Healey was a communist. You know, there were plenty of respectable people who considered themselves communists.
Yeah, or even Stalinist.
Yeah, or just because that was actually the strongest organisation fighting fascism. Back, rather than the lily-livered response of the British government was to say, let's just try and not intervene on either side and you're both as bad as each other, and which, of course, is why Franco would eventually succeed.
The Spanish government actually gave citizenship, didn't they, in the 90s, I think, to the members of the International Brigade that were still alive, which were about 600 of them.
Wow.
And in 1996, Jacques Chirac granted the former French members of the International Brigade a legal status of former service personnel.
Oh, that's cool.
So they were recognised as veterans. Yeah.
Wow.
There you go.
So they were fighting in Catalonia and in the defence of Madrid. Franco had moved fast towards Madrid when the war broke out in 1936, and everyone thought, Madrid is going to fall really quickly. Remember that these Republican armies were quite improvised and disparate and didn't have the tanks and the equipment and the discipline.
I mean, reading
Franco.
Homage to Catalonia, the stories of the ancient pre-World War I rifles they were using, you know.
And yet they held out Madrid for over 2 years, and Franco was pushed back. He had four columns marching on Madrid, and he said, "I will take Madrid because I have a fifth column on the inside." And that's where we get the phrase fifth columnists from Franco's attempt to take Madrid with people who would betray.
And for anyone listening who doesn't know what fifth columnists are, they are a sort of the invading faction that already exists within the...
Yeah, the traitors on the inside.
On the inside, really.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm in 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
The Nationalists made gain in the north. They took the Basque country, where they promptly banned the Basque language, and they eventually managed to divide the Republican areas in two. So you had Catalonia, you know, where Barcelona is, separated from Madrid and the south coast. Really, the fascists only had one defeat in the whole war, in the Battle of Guadalajara. And the poor Republicans were sort of stymied by, as I say, amateur troops, divided leadership, Stalinist purges, but most of all, not having massive foreign aid as the fascists
not
did.
Having Hitler's money.
I did say, you know, that Franco wasn't particularly ideological, but it was deeply, deeply conservative. Mm. And as areas fell under nationalist control, the new regime imposed its sort of deeply social conservatism on them. So divorce became illegal once again. The Republic had made it divorce legal. They'd made abortion legal. Abortion was legal for the first time anywhere in Western Europe in Republican Spain. In terms of what they had to do for women, let me read a bit out of this book, The Spanish Civil War by David Mitchell, not David Mitchell from Peep Show. Oh, not even David Mitchell, the novelist, I don't think. In keeping with the Caudillo, that's Franco, Caudillo's newfound piety, the tone was solemn and prudish. All women between the ages of 17 and 35 had to promise on the Sacred Heart of Jesus to observe modesty in dress, long sleeves, high necks, skirts to the ankles, blouses full at the chest, to read no novels, newspapers or magazines, to go to no cinema or theatre without ecclesiastical licence, neither publicly nor privately to dance the dances of this century, but to learn the old dances.
Wow. What age group was that? Women?
Women between 17 and 35.
Wow. So I'm 43, so now I can read novels with my tits out. Is that right?
I think that's what they were saying.
Good to know.
It's like, right, I didn't read the rest of it. That's what it says in the second paragraph. Once you got past this, you can read.
Do what you like. No one's interested in you once you're over 35 anyway. You stop being attractive to men, so it doesn't matter what you do.
50 Shades of Grey in the nuddy after that. But can you... I've never really heard of such thing as women reading no novels. I mean, I know I shouldn't be shocked at the fascists and they were murdering people left, right and centre. Mm. But to say that a woman couldn't read a novel or a magazine, it's just astonishing.
Well, they might learn things. Might they? I mean, Jane Austen was, you know, had some little radical thoughts in there that, you know, didn't want to put those in the pretty little heads of ladies.
they're not even prescribing books. They're saying you're not allowed to read fiction. Yeah. Sorry, I shouldn't be so shocked, but I just thought that was astonishing because I'd never really come across anything like that before. Mm. As the war got worse, and you know, the Republicans were more and more on the defensive, the best they were thinking they might hope for is a two-state solution where there's a nationalist Spain and a Republican Spain. Mm. But Franco was determined to pursue unconditional surrender all the way and to make sure that future division would be impossible by killing everyone who disagreed with him. So he unified the nationalist parties into one. And when one of the Falangist leaders resisted this idea, he had him imprisoned and put on trial for treason. So that's the sort of, you know,
nice guy.
No nonsense that they had. So all this time, the Republicans' greatest hope is Britain and France, and thinking that Hitler is pushing it in Europe, Mussolini is bombing Abyssinia, that Britain will say, enough is enough, fascists, and stop Hitler at in the Rhineland or in Austria or in the Sudetenland. But when the Munich Agreement came up, when the Munich Agreement happened and Hitler was basically allowed to do whatever he wanted in Czechoslovakia.
This is Chamberlain's really Peace Now Time and all of that.
That was basically the fast nail in the coffin for the Spanish Republicans, because they gave up hope that there would be a Europe-wide halt to the rise of fascism. Mm. They were thinking that they'd hoped that, you know, war against Germany, Italy and the fascists in Spain might be one their best chance. In fact, they're probably as good as defeated already militarily. And Catalonia was conquered in February 1939. Catalonian language banned, of course. Mm-hmm. Old-fashioned Spanish sort of culture imposed everywhere. There was to be no menus in French, no foreign songs. The Catholic Church re-established. You had to go to church by law. In Madrid, there was a sort of an attempted coup against the Republicans holding out, so there's a civil war within the civil war. But in March 39, the Nationalists finally occupied Madrid, and Franco proclaimed victory on the 1st of April 39.
So April Fool's Day, he was only kidding.
Yeah, no, God. Yeah, 1939, gotcha. So, you know, just as the war was ending, the rest of the continent was sliding into a bigger and equally brutal war.
Yeah, we're talking just a few months.
Yeah, away. I think it's fair enough to say that, like Czechoslovakia, Spain was a victim of appeasement.
Yeah.
And as we said with Goering, you know, saying to Mussolini, the Brits won't let us do this. One of the historians I read said that with that, if Britain had stopped the fascists in Spain, there might not have been a Second World War.
There's pretty much everything I've read has said that. I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
But yeah.
There probably wouldn't have been a Second World War had those fascists been stopped at that point.
Because every signal Britain and France had given Hitler was, you can do what you want.
Yeah.
And so Hitler didn't expect war when he invaded Poland. He thought that they're going to let me do this as well, because I can just do whatever I want. So if we'd stopped them in Spain or in Czechoslovakia, I think that a lot of death and misery might have been prevented. Once war had been won, there was no sense of, let's try and heal this country and bring us together. It was incredibly brutal reprisals, and thousands of Republicans were executed. Who knows how many? The estimates range from 30,000 to 200,000, including deaths of forced labour, because they made the Republicans build canals and roads and monuments to the fallen, which was and people died building monuments to the fallen through slave labour. It has to be said that if a Republican victory, you know, would not have meant Spain turning into 1970s Sweden, those divisions and Stalinist purges would have continued, and maybe another civil war would have come after that.
Almost certainly would, wouldn't it? Because there were so many factions were part of the Republican side. There's no way they would have just lived in harmony forevermore, amen.
No. I mean, and then we're talking about the International Brigade. They weren't welcomed as, you know, heroes when they came back home by their governments.
No.
They were discredited. And in America, anyone who'd fought in the Spanish Civil War, come the late 1940s, the McCarthyists would label them as communists, and they'd be hounded out of work, you know, blacklisted, and labelled as communist traitors. Spain was isolated after the defeat of the Axis powers in 1945, and was suddenly this lone fascist power. Spain and Portugal, these lone fascist powers on the edge of the continent, boycotted by the left. There's a holiday destination. My dad would always go, "We're not going to Spain till Franco dies." Lots of the Republicans escaped. Some of them went to Mexico, where they were okay, but some went to France. And you're an anti-fascist escaping France in 1939. A year later, the Nazis move in, and you're suddenly being arrested by the Petain government. So the leader of the Republicans in Spain, Largo Caballero, He was sent to a German concentration camp. Lots of them were imprisoned and died in concentration camps during the war. Spain gradually opened up in the 1960s, tourism replacing agriculture. Mm-hmm. And Franco died in 1975. Remember that very well.
Before I was born, John.
Was it?
Only just, but I was born in 76.
I remember the pause on the news. I remember watching this guy in Spanish going, Franco is the more. It was like the drama with its just newsreader gave this terrible news to Spain. You know, he'd been sort of ill for ages.
Yeah.
And it was Juan Carlos came as a...
So the monarchy restored?
Constitutional monarchy. But the divisions ran very, very deep. And it took a long time for the truth to really be discussed. And it's the young people now who are really saying, we want to know what happened. And graves are being dug up now.
You say it's a real movement in that, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
To sort of find out exactly what happened.
In fact, only last year was Franco's body finally removed from the massive monument of the fallen, because he's a, you know, he's a criminal and a murderer rather than a national hero. And he was buried at a private chapel. But that came after much campaigning and much bitter argument of reopening these old wounds, or, you know, having truth and reconciliation. The bad people always want to say, oh, let's bygones be bygones. And people go, no, we need to process this as a country. We need to face up to what we did.
Yeah. Which, you know, you have to say is something Germany did do.
They did do. They sort of forced to do it because they were under occupation, I suppose.
Well, yeah.
Because East Germany didn't do it so well, did they? We sort of did.
Well,
that
East Germany sort of convinced themselves that they'd had nothing to do with the Nazis at all.
They were the victims.
It was them
fascism.
Over there.
Yeah.
What did it? Not us.
Yeah. So, you know, that was the Spanish Civil War. A very, very bleak and dark episode in European history.
And in our podcast, consequently.
And in podcast. So not a lot of laughs this week. I mean, they always say that... history is written by the winners, but I'd say the history of the Spanish War was written by the losers, really, because of the wider context of fascism being defeated across Europe.
Yeah.
You know, we have been able to talk about what Franco did and the...
It was only in Spain where it wasn't, really, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. But in the rest of the world, the history of the Spanish War was written by the losers.
Mm-hmm.
It's only now that, you know, more and more truth is coming out, and the level of the murders and the scale of the executions and the brutality of the repression and the randomness of the executions makes you realise what a complete psychopath Franco and the military junta were.
Absolutely.
Anything else?
I don't think so.
Up on your reading?
Sort of. Well, I was just going to say the books that we Battle for Spain, Battle of Spain.
Yes.
Anthony Beaver.
That's the Beaver one. Yeah.
It's quite a tome. But it's got lots of information in it, and obviously Homage to Catalonia, which I am working on. I will finish it.
And then there's Hemingway had a huge hit with his novel For Whom the Bell Tolls,
yes,
of course, which I think he started, you know, sitting out there in Madrid with Martha Gellhorn, you know, who was out there as well. I read A Concise History of the Spanish Civil War by Gabriel Jackson, which was very good, and lots of illustrations in both these books. And then the other one was The Spanish Civil War by David Mitchell.
Not that
David Mitchell.
Or the other one.
Or the novelist David Mitchell. Or the Tory MP David Mitchell. I think there's a lot of David Mitchell. But a deeply political subject, which I always wanted to know more, and I'm glad I did it. Mm. Glad you suggested it, Angela.
Yeah. I'd sort of, you know, it was always there, but I just didn't know any of the details, really. So, yeah, it's been interesting.
Okay, well, next week we'll do something lighter.
Yeah, but, will we though?
With less death, I think. I think is what we're planning.
A little less death.
So that's all from We Are History this week. Rate us, review us.
Yeah, give us 5 stars on iTunes. You know you want to. Do us a little review. Please, yeah. I think the biggest plea we have now is, can you tell your friends and family, get them to subscribe and to listen? Because we're doing all right in the numbers, but we can always do for more. And we will just spread the word. And also, special thank you to Spike, our producer, who is managing to make this work remotely, whereas John and I are old fuddy-duddies who don't know what we're doing. Spike has properly come into his own now while we're doing this under lockdown.
Oh, Spike, I've just realised I didn't have my microphone on. Can we do the whole thing again?
Did you press play and record, John?
I didn't press play and record. Let's start again. Till next week on We Are History.
Don't forget to tweet us as well @We Are History Pod. Goodbye.
Bye.